I'm Mike Mason with a check of the local news on KDLG. U.S. Senator Mark Begich is in the midst of a campaign for re-election, and the race is being closely watched as it could determine the balance of power in the U.S. Senate. Earlier today, Senator Begich answered questions on Alaska Public Media's Talk of Alaska program. Begich is a Democrat. That puts him in the majority in the U.S. Senate. However, the Republican Party is hoping to switch the Senate to the Republicans in the November general election, and they have their sights set on Begich's seat. Begich has been campaigning hard in recent months, which includes attending nearly every forum, event, and debate in Alaska. He sat down for an hour-long interview today that included questions from Alaskans from across the state. One of the first questions posed to Begich concerned the instability in the Middle East and the efforts to stop the growth of the Islamic State.
I supported the airstrikes because they're multinational, led by the Arab nations. But when it comes to putting combat troops on the ground, and let me make this very clear, we have U.S. citizens and other embassies and so forth within the region that we need to protect against ISIS, no question about that. But we don't need, in my opinion, to put combat troops back on the ground in an area that really the Arab states need to step up. The Arab countries need to step up to their responsibility.
Despite the fact that he's just wrapping up his first term in the Senate, Mark Begich is considered a powerful member of the Senate majority. He sits on the Senate Appropriations Committee and is the chairman of the Fisheries and Coast Guard subcommittee that is tasked with taking the lead in reauthorizing the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which is the law that governs the federal fisheries. Begich stresses that if he's reelected, the whole process will not have to start again with the new Congress that begins next year.
And if we don't accomplish this before the year's out, we're not going to go restart this whole thing up again. We will bring the bill immediately back up in the beginning of the session. We will not go through the whole committee process again because we've done the work. And it's a good piece of legislation with some tweaks we still have to make on it.
On Monday, Senator Begich held a rally with several women supporters to unveil what he is calling the Standing Up for Alaska Women and Families plan. He outlined the guiding principles of that plan during today's Talk of Alaska program. In the plan, Begich stresses his support for efforts to help women advance in the workplace and start businesses.
For small businesses, women have a harder time getting access to capital. That's statistically proven. So to create more micro-lending possibilities out of the Small Business Administration. So women who want to start their small businesses have access to capital, low-cost capital. The other thing is student loans. This affects not only everybody, but it has, for households, it's a huge impact. And what we're finding is, again, for women who have high loan burden on student loans, they're unable to access potentially for a new home and other kind of credit. We have bills pending and ones that we're going to propose that lower the interest rate to 3.85% for new loans, but also refinancing of student loans. Because some have large debts of private loans they've borrowed and public loans. This would combine them, lower the rate to about 4%. Freeing up cash for individuals, predominantly women fall in this category, would have been able to use those resources for growth in their family, new home, business, whatever it is.
Other aspects of Begich's plan for women and families include pushing the passage of the Paycheck Fairness Act of 2014 and calling for an end to gender-based wage discrimination both nationally and in Alaska. During today's interview, Senator Begich was asked about the Supreme Court decision that came down back in late June that has come to be known as the Hobby Lobby decision. Begich asserts the Supreme Court made a huge mistake.
What this decision says is if your employer, for reasons, religious reasons or other reasons, believes that they don't want to provide or allow the insurance company who they've contracted with to provide preventive health, in this case, birth control, they can deny it. Even though it's an insurance policy that they have contracted with the insurance company to provide, then they decide and start picking what in the insurance policy you should get and what you shouldn't get based on their personal beliefs. This is very dangerous. And it's not just, some people said, well, it's only four types of the 20 birth control methods. And I said, no, that was the first day ruling. The second day ruling where they added their final decision, added all of the birth control issues, or all the birth control methods would be able to be denied for women. I think it's a big mistake. I mean, what next? I mean, are they going to say because they don't like blood transfusions, then you as an employee, we won't cover that? Or let's say you're working for someone that doesn't believe in medicines or healthcare like we have today and says, well, you got insurance, but we're not going to allow these five or 10 things. That is not the Supreme Court took something that was an old law and interpreted almost the reverse. The idea of the original law that they interpreted was to protect the employee from religious beliefs that would be imposed onto these employees. And now they've used it to figure it out to deny women health care coverage, and in this case, birth control, which I think is a huge mistake.
Senator Begich disagreed so strongly with the Hobby Lobby decision that he co-sponsored and voted for a bill that sought to make it illegal for a company to deny workers health benefits required by federal law, including birth control. Senator Begich replaced Senator Ted Stevens in the Senate in 2008 after serving 6 years as the mayor of Anchorage. He's the son of the late Nick Begich, who was Alaska's third U.S. congressman. Nick Begich was killed in 1972 when his airplane disappeared in the Gulf of Alaska. Senator Begich was the guest during today's Talk of Alaska program on the Alaska Public Radio Network. Last week, the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals struck down same-sex marriage bans in Nevada and Idaho. Because of that ruling, the U.S. District Court Judge Timothy Burgess found that the same-sex marriage ban was a violation in Alaska of both due process and equal protection under the 14th Amendment. KDLG's Thea Card has the details.
1998 marked the year the voters of Alaska added an amendment to the Alaska Constitution that defined marriage as being between one man and one woman. In May, five gay couples filed a lawsuit challenging Alaska's ban on same-sex marriage. The suit also called for the barring of any state laws that refused to recognize gay marriage as legally performed in other states or countries, or that prevented unmarried gay couples from marrying. Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska, Joshua Decker, says the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision is nothing but good news for Alaska.
It's great news for all Alaskans who care about equality, and it's great news for same-sex couples who are in committed, loving relationships, because the Ninth Circuit very clearly said that discriminatory bans on equal marriage, such as the one in Alaska, are absolutely dead on arrival.
On Sunday, Judge Burgess ordered the state of Alaska to immediately start issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples and recognize marriages from other states. Governor Sean Parnell said in a press release that he will appeal the ruling in order to defend and uphold the law and the Alaska Constitution. However, the removal on the ban of same-sex marriage could be an economic opportunity for the state of Alaska. A new study called Estimating the Economic Boost of Marriage for Same-Sex Couples in Alaska states that same-sex couples could add $8 million in spending to the state economy. Senior counsel at the Williams Institute at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Law, Christy Mallory, is an author on the study. She says the researchers estimate that 600 same-sex couples will get married in Alaska once they're able.
Over the first 3 years, this would bring about $8 million in revenue to the state and local economy, and about $135,000 in sales tax revenue.
Mallory says the figures come from an estimated total average of money spent on wedding ceremonies and celebrations, including out-of-state guests traveling to Alaska. Spending related to same-sex couples' weddings would create 26 to 79 jobs in the tourism and recreation sector for the state.
And as far as couples go, we estimate that about half will marry in the first 3 years that they're allowed to. This is a pattern that we've seen in Massachusetts and other states. We don't take into account couples that will travel to the state to marry. So, you know, people who are, for example, from here in California and think Alaska is beautiful and want to take their wedding up there and bring all their guests, we don't count that. So that'll be an additional impact.
Although Burgess denied a delay sought by the state on Friday for oral arguments, the state is currently appealing for a stay on the ruling. The ACLU of Alaska issued a press release shortly after expressing its disappointment in the governor. Decker says that Burgess's ruling left no place for discrimination in Alaska or America.
The Ninth Circuit clearly and forcefully engaged all the arguments that Alaska made trying to defend its indefensible ban on equal marriage, and the Ninth Circuit threw all of them out.
Gay marriage, which was not an issue being discussed heavily during the campaign so far, has suddenly become a hot topic among the candidates running for governor. Parnell's campaign for re-election issued a release asking if independent gubernatorial candidate Bill Walker would defend Alaska's constitution by fighting the gay marriage ruling. Walker, an attorney, responded, although he personally believes marriage should only be between one man and one woman, he did not support the state's decision to appeal. He added that if he were governor, he would uphold the laws of the land. If the stay is denied, gay couples across the state that applied for marriage licenses on Monday could be having their ceremonies as early as Thursday. In Dillingham, I'm Thea Card.
A woman from Togiak is facing drug charges for allegedly smoking oxycodone at the Kanackanack Hospital in Dillingham. Last Thursday afternoon, the Dillingham Police Department was asked to investigate a report that a pregnant woman and another woman who had just given birth were smoking oxycodone in the delivery OB room at the Kanackanack Hospital. The request was made by the state's Office of Children's Services. In a statement that was issued Monday, the Dillingham Police Department reports that the investigation found that 25-year-old Jennifer Williams from Togiak allegedly smoked oxycodone with a friend who had successfully given birth at the hospital. The police claimed the newborn infant was present at the time. Dillingham Police Department reports that Williams was found to be in possession of 15 oxycodone pills that were not prescribed. They also claim that Williams was in possession of alcohol that they believe she intended to import into Togiak, which is a dry community. Jennifer Williams has been charged with a couple of felony drug charges. In other local law enforcement news, a vehicle fire was discovered last Thursday morning at around 4:45 a.m. A police patrol spotted the vehicle fire at a residence on Gauthier Way in Dillingham. Dillingham Volunteer Fire Department was successful in putting the vehicle fire out and preventing the fire from spreading to the residents. The vehicle was a total loss, and the Dillingham Police Department reports that the fire was deliberately started in the bed of the pickup. The police department confirms they're investigating a person of interest who's been identified in the case, but they are asking for the public's help with information about the fire. If you know anything, you can call the Dillingham Police Department. The number is 842-5354. This year was the 50th anniversary of the Great Alaska Earthquake, and earlier this summer, a magnitude 6.2 quake shook south-central Alaska. The state has earthquakes on its mind. That's why thousands of residents have already signed up to take part in the largest earthquake drill in the world on Thursday.
On October 16th at 10:16, Alaska will be doing the Great Alaska Shakeout. But there's many other states and nations throughout the world that will be doing a shakeout drill on the same day at the same time.
Jeremy Zedek works for the state's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. He says to date, more than 20 million people are signed up to participate worldwide. That includes more than 76,000 Alaskans.
Alaska is the most active seismic region in the United States. We've also had the largest earthquake in North American history and three of the six largest earthquakes recorded in the world. So it is really important that we prepare for earthquakes here.
Participants of the Great Alaska Shakeout will simulate being in an earthquake and do three things just to stay safe. Drop to the ground, find some type of cover to protect themselves, and hold on. He says his office found that groups that had regularly participated in earthquake drills were the quickest to act when real quakes struck earlier this year.
Earthquakes are no-notice events, so they're going to strike, and unless people actively practice what they're going to do when that earthquake hits, there may be confusion, they don't know what to do, they don't remember drop, cover, and hold, and they try to run out or they expose themselves to other falling objects. So we really want people to practice the drop, cover, and hold. So when that shaking begins and there's a little bit of panic, they'll know what to do.
For more information or to sign up, go to shakeout.org. If you're a student, faculty, or staff member of the University of Alaska, you may receive a survey in your mail this month asking questions about sexual assaults on campus. The survey follows campus visits by federal investigators looking into how the college handles sexual assault complaints and violations. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
This is the first time the University of Alaska is conducting a campus climate survey. Michael O'Brien is a university attorney.
We want to have an understanding and ground truth how people feel sexual assault is being dealt with on our campuses. And it's a way to determine if there are areas of concern that we're unaware of.
This is also the first year the White House has recommended that schools around the country conduct campus climate surveys. The university's statewide institutional research and budget department is conducting the survey with help from the University of Alaska Anchorage's Justice Center. The roughly 50 multiple choice questions are modeled after sample ones provided by the federal government. O'Brien warns the language of the survey is explicit.
Because we don't all share the same definitions of sexual assault, it has to go through a lot of explaining. Like, you wouldn't want someone to say, well, you know, no, I've never been sexually assaulted. I mean, every once in a while, I'll drink too much and my boyfriend will have sex with me when I'm passed out, but I've never been sexually assaulted. That is also sexual assault.
Students, faculty, and staff at University of Alaska have already been notified of the survey. O'Brien says around 18,000 will be randomly selected to participate, and all of them will get resources for counseling and reporting sexual assault.
We anticipate that when people are confronted with this sort of information, it often triggers a response. That's not the goal of it. We're not trying to trigger responses or draw out victims, but we realize that that could happen.
The survey is confidential and voluntary. O'Brien says results are anticipated before the end of the year. He doesn't know if they'll be made public. Lori Klein is the Student Conduct Administrator at the University of Alaska Southeast. She says the university is also looking at how to reach and engage students who aren't on a campus.
A big portion of our population are distance students, and they don't necessarily have a campus climate to speak to, but they could be anywhere, and they could be accessing buildings across our state that are in partnership with the university to provide students with space to access our classes. We care about those climates.
As part of an ongoing examination, federal investigators visited four campuses of the University of Alaska last week, hoping to hear from students. At the UAS Juneau campus, only two attended the women's focus group, but an investigator says other campus sessions drew up to 25 students. O'Brien says the federal investigation continues and won't likely be resolved for another several months. After that, he says the university can expect years of monitoring. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
U.S. Senator Mark Begich has signed a pledge that would make third-party ad spending in the Senate race more transparent. His challenger, Dan Sullivan, refused to sign it and has accused Begich of not signing his pledge to curb outside spending. KSTK's Katrina Sitarik reports.
The Alaska Senate race has received national attention for its attack ads. It's one of the most competitive Senate races in the country, and undisclosed groups are spending millions of dollars on advertising. Democratic incumbent Senator Mark Begich says he asked Republican challenger Dan Sullivan to join him in signing a pledge that would make those ads disclose their origin.
Sullivan said no. I was disappointed. He said it before probably he even got the email. So I'm a little disappointed that he was unwilling to sign up and make the pledge of disclosure.
In a recent interview, Sullivan said Begich rejected his pledge to curb outside spending.
We were very serious when we put forward this Alaska agreement to Mark Begich. It was an effective, immediate way to stop this outside spending, and he rejected it within 2 hours.
The proposed pledges are different. Begich's pledge would penalize a campaign if the third-party funding source for an ad is not disclosed. Sullivan's agreement, put forth in June, would penalize a campaign if outside groups aired any supporting radio or TV ads. But the candidates give similar reasons for signing the pledges. Here's Begich.
This outside money is corrosive to the political process. It is not giving an opportunity for the voice of the candidate to speak their mind and talk about the issues. Instead, it has gotten back and forth. And these ads that these guys are running have been proven false time and time again.
And here's Sullivan.
And not only is it bad, I think, because it's drowning out other races, like the governor's races and state representative and state senator races, but it doesn't allow campaigns to kind of say, hey, this is my ad. Because those are outside groups. You don't coordinate with them. You don't know who's doing what.
Both candidates rejected each other's efforts at reducing outside spending, so it will stay in the race. Alaskans can expect to see a lot more third-party political ads in the run-up to the November 4th general election. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Katerina Sestarik.
A new report details the challenges involved in providing health care to rural communities in Alaska. The study concludes there's a lack of professional expertise in the state's smaller communities. The report, called Alaska's Community Capacity Review, a statewide public health system assessment, also notes that an aging healthcare workforce is a challenge as well. State Health Promotion Manager Jane Andreen, who worked on the report, says there's a need for mentors to counter an aging workforce. The report says northern and southwest regions of the state are most lacking in healthcare providers. The report was released on the 1st of October. It's based on a performance review of the public health system that was taken earlier this year. And the official election results are in for the Bristol Bay Borough's recent election. Carl Anderson will replace Daniel O'Hara as mayor. Russell Phelps won the open assembly seat, replacing Shelby Booth. Yvonne Phelps and Diane King, who both ran unopposed, will take the two open school board seats. Many of the stories you hear during the KDLG local news can be found online at kdlg.org. You can also find contact information on that website if you would like to provide a comment, a correction, or a news tip. That's a check of the local news on listener-supported public radio KDLG. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason, reporting.